This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Almost a decade ago, Dr. Richard Besser, the chief medical editor for ABC News, lost his sister while she was having elective surgery. Since then, he's been a vocal advocate for patients demanding information from their healthcare providers.
When you're bombarded with information and you don't know what is hype and what is real, it can be very confusing.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear about the book, Tell Me the Truth, Doctor.
We'll also hear about the health concerns being raised by the increasing popularity of raw milk cheese. And hear the story of two women dealing with breast cancer in two different worlds. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show.
Dr. Richard Besser is chief medical editor for ABC News and a practicing pediatrician who has made a name for himself by sifting through a barrage of medical literature, examining the evidence, and turning an informed, unbiased analysis into straightforward advice. What anyone would hope to receive from their personal physician. Dr. Besser's sister died during elective surgery in 2004. That tragedy defined his mission to empower people to understand and take responsibility for their health by questioning their doctor, asking for a second opinion, and learning how to protect themselves from things that can go wrong during treatments.
In his new book called Tell Me the Truth, Doctor, easy-to-understand answers to your most confusing and critical health questions, Dr. Besser addresses some of the most controversial and hotly debated current health and wellness issues. He spoke about the book with The Health Show's Joe Donahue.
When you look at your job as the chief health and medical editor at ABC News, and a book like this fits into that in the sense of you are trying to make us, the general public, more aware of very important health issues, and I think it seems, considering you did a whole book on this, that we as a public have a lot of questions, don't we?
I think so. You know, I get questions all the time wherever I am, and it's really no surprise. There's so much confusing information out there. Part of it is that there's just so much information available to us, either on the web or through media or through friends. It's hard to know what to believe.
Why is that the case, do you think? I mean, because there is so much information, we don't know what to believe, but science is science, right? So where does that end?
You know, I'm a great believer in science and the power of science, but science can also be misused. And it can be very difficult to tell the difference between a paper that comes out that really is what I would call advocacy science, a paper designed to sell a product or promote a treatment, and science that has less bias to it. You know, my background before coming to ABC, I was at the CDC for 13 years, and left there as the acting director, and the goal there was to really wade through evidence and come up with the best recommendations for people so that they could take charge of their health and make decisions to improve their health. But when you're bombarded with information and you don't know what is hype and what is real, it can be very confusing.
Okay, so when you give us advice, then we choose if we are going to trust you, right? So it's the same thing with our personal doctor. If they tell us something, there's very much an issue of trust here of who has the final say.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the points I make is that one of the most important things you can do for your health is before you get sick or when you're not sick, find a doctor who you can really talk to and work on establishing that relationship of trust, because it is so important, and you want someone that you can turn to bounce things off of.
And the thing about people like you, i.e. doctors who do this on a public scale and in a journalistic and broadcasting world, is that in some ways we have more access to you and your information than we do to our own personal doctors. Getting an appointment, getting an answer can take a long time.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things I hear all the time. With appointments getting squeezed into shorter and shorter time slots, it's hard to feel that comfort and the luxury to really have a conversation and to ask those questions. And so getting information before you go in for that visit, either by reading books or going to credible websites and reading, can help you make use of that limited time you have on that visit.
One of the sections in the book, chapter 3, is "Oh, Doctor, One More Thing." Your questions when I'm walking out the door, and you make this case in the book that's often the most important. That's what's weighing on the patient's mind, right? Even though it's sort of the last minute, that's what they're there for.
Yeah, I always like to leave time for that, because so often a parent will come in with a child, and I hear this, you know, from adults as well when they see their doctor. There's something that's really on their mind. It may be a difficult question or an uncomfortable question to ask, or they feel that they're stupid to ask that question, and they wait until your hand is on that doorknob, and they say, "Oh, doc, just one more thing." And that's often the main reason they're there. And if you don't leave time for that, you're really doing your patient a disservice.
And some of it's general. You have one in here is antibacterial soap better than plain soap.
Yeah. You know, I started the program at CDC on promoting appropriate antibiotic use. And one of the public health issues that really concerns me is growing antimicrobial or antibiotic resistance. And coming out of that, there has been a lot of marketing of antibacterial or antimicrobial everything. This sense that you can sterilize your world and that you should. And the data are pretty strong that good old hand washing with soap and water is every bit as good as washing with something that's antimicrobial. And there's a theoretical risk that using all these antibacterial products can promote resistance in your environment and set you up for something that you really don't want to get. So I'm a big fan of hand washing with good old soap and water, using alcohol sanitizers when you don't have access to that.
I've also noticed there's quite a few questions in the book having to do with technology, such as, can using an iPad damage my hearing, or do cell phones cause brain cancer? We have an interest now in this. We are so tied to our technology. Of what impact is it having on our health?
Yeah, it's a big concern. You know, clearly there is a risk from iPods and other music devices when they're played too loud. My generation, it was going to concerts and standing too close to the speakers, our ears would ring. But now you can be barraged with that every single day. And so it's so important that kids learn to turn it down. They're at an age frequently where they feel invincible, and it's a hard thing to do. But if you can negotiate around setting some volume limits to those devices, it's a good idea. The cell phone and cancer question, I've probably done more stories on that than anything else at ABC News, because there is such a fear of these devices and how dependent we've become on them that they could have a negative health consequence. As I look at the evidence, I don't see any risk of these devices and cancer. But that doesn't mean, if you're concerned, that there aren't easy things that you can do to reduce your contact with the devices. They are optional. You can text instead of talk on them, and you can use hands-free devices. But the science does not support it. And the reason is, although they release radiation, it's not the type of radiation called ionizing radiation that directly damages our cells and our DNA.
Again, the name of Dr. Richard Besser's new book is Tell Me the Truth, Doctor, Easy to Understand Answers to Your Most Confusing and Critical Health Questions. He spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue. Sales of specialty cheeses sold in U.S. grocery stores grew by 7% last year, in large part because of increasing demand for exotic artisanal cheeses and even raw cheeses made from unpasteurized milk. Raw milk cheese has gathered a fervent following for its taste, nutritional benefits, and freshness. But as Abby Fentress Swanson reports for Harvest Public Media, recent safety concerns threaten the market.
I've spent a lot of time in front of cheese coolers in my life. That's because I love cheese, whether it's Stilton, Gruyere, or Drunken Goat. But raw milk cheese? That's new to me. So I asked Noah Earl, the grocery manager at Clover's Natural Market in Columbia, Missouri, to recommend a raw milk cheese for me to try.
I thought I'd choose a couple cheddars, if you're game.
Cool. We head to the back of the store and slice up a shiny yellow raw milk cheddar.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Hmm. I wasn't really expecting that.
No.
It's very smooth. It's smoother in consistency than the one we just tried.
Mm-hmm.
We were just eating that raw cheese straight, but Clover's customer Senyata Markey likes her raw cheese on top of apples. In fact, she doesn't eat cheese unless it's raw because her blood's type A.
Type A is, just because of our biology, do not digest dairy well or meat, and we're unable to assimilate the nutrients from those products. Now, mainly when it comes to dairy, I feel like it was part of the pasteurization process that makes it unavailable to me. And so the raw cheese, I could eat.
Consumers like Markey believe that raw cheese is more nutritious because pasteurization hasn't killed living beneficial organisms in the milk. But not pasteurizing can also allow harmful bacteria to live. And contamination problems have been a challenge for Missouri cheesemakers lately. Morningland Dairy in Mountain View, Missouri, just went out of business after the state milk board seized 36,000 pounds of its raw cheese because some of it was found to be contaminated with listeria and staph. Also in the northwestern part of the state, three people got sick after eating a raw cheese called Flory's Favorite. A batch of it tested positive for E. coli. Nebraska cheesemaker Krista Dittman says these problems can be devastating for the raw milk industry.
I think it creates a lot of fear in the industry, and it creates a lot of dissonance between producers and regulators.
Dittman's talking about the feeling from small producers that inspectors from state agriculture departments and the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the raw milk cheese industry, will never find their operations to be clean enough or safe enough to meet their standards. Morningland Dairy's lawyer Pete Kennedy points out another fear.
Well, I think it creates a chilling effect on other people getting into the business. You know, you're going to spend all that money on equipment and a plant if something like this can happen.
But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say raw milk cheese poses a very real threat, sickening hundreds of people over the past decade. A few years ago, the FDA began a comprehensive risk assessment of raw milk cheese, which can be sold legally nationwide as long as it has been aged 60 days. The FDA is expected to release its findings by the end of September, and some producers worry the agency will extend the amount of time required to age raw cheese, or, worse, ban the sale of raw cheese across state lines. But food safety expert Richard Raymond wouldn't mind a raw milk cheese ban.
The pasteurization of milk, which became more or less the standard in the 1940s, dramatically dropped the incidence of foodborne illnesses, particularly in children, because it's a very simple step to guarantee the safety of the milk.
Back at Clover's, a regular named Kathy Lane stands in one of my favorite spots at the cheese cooler and gazes at the dozens of delectable cheeses available for sale. She and her 11-year-old daughter don't eat products made from pasteurized cow's milk due to antibiotics that might be found in them. But she's still debating whether or not to try raw milk cheese.
Would you ever consider raw milk or raw milk cheese?
Good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I would try it, but I'm not sure.
For the raw milk cheese industry, that uncertainty is a familiar feeling. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Still to come, how a woman deals with breast cancer can depend on where she lives. That story's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1316.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. There are some things about breast cancer that are universal. There's the initial fear. There's a sense that your body has betrayed you in a very personal way. But some parts of the breast cancer experience very much depend on where you live. Reporter Joanne Silberner of Seattle, Washington, compares her experience to that of a woman in Uganda, where there are few treatment options and the disease is highly stigmatized.
My name is Joanne Silberner. I'm a freelance reporter, and I teach journalism at the University of Washington. Last year, I traveled to Uganda, Haiti, and India to do radio stories about cancer in developing countries. I met a woman in Uganda who, like me, has had breast cancer. I spent an afternoon hearing about her experiences, and I came home and I started thinking about mine. In some ways, her story is a lot like mine, and in other ways, our stories are very different. On August 9th, 2010, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
My name is Gertrude Nachigude. I'm an accountant. I'm a founding member for Uganda Women's Cancer Support Organization. And this is an organization formed by breast cancer survivors. My finding out, I just touched my breast accidentally and felt a swelling, and which swelling I didn't take serious. I touched it, felt it, and I didn't mind. I was sharing a house with a friend, and I told her. Then she said, why you bother about something that's not painful? So I also kept quiet. I had a lamp fire. I didn't go to hospital. I had it. I always felt it.
I got my breast cancer diagnosis after a routine mammogram. It came 3 days before I was scheduled to move 2,700 miles from Atlanta to Seattle. I knew I'd get breast cancer. My mom died of it. My dad was exposed to radiation during medical training, and he got it too. But I had trouble believing the initial diagnosis. I figured the Atlanta doctors had gotten a little too excited about some equivocal tests.
It was after like 8 months. It had started growing big. Every time I touched, it was bigger than before. But at one time, I felt a sharp pain. And that's when I decided to take to a surgeon to remove it. To me, it was remove it. And when they removed it, that's when they told me I had breast cancer. When I heard that it was cancer, the feeling was terrible. I knew it was death. Here, people believe cancer is an untreatable disease.
In Seattle, doctors confirmed my diagnosis. Definitely cancer. And it definitely had to go. If you're going to have breast cancer, you may as well be me. As a journalist, I understand the issues pretty well. I've been writing about advances and controversies in breast cancer treatment for 30 years. My husband is a physician, and he understands things even better. I had enormous support from him and from the rest of my family. I knew what to do, and I could afford it. I was and remain fully insured.
For me, getting treatment was also another nightmare because there was no free treatment at that time. And my family wasn't a rich family. Nobody knew what to do. My family didn't know what to do. Nobody. We didn't even know where cancer is treated. We went to clinic. Of course, you pay money. And when we had spent all the money, I had to go to Mulago because I know it's a government hospital and it's free.
Early on a Tuesday morning, I had a mastectomy. It was a rare sunny day in Seattle, and I got immediate reconstruction. That night, the hospital served fresh salmon for dinner. This is Seattle, after all. My husband slept in a chair beside me. The next day, we went home.
I got mastectomy, and I had surgery for the total removal of the breast. And then when I recovered 1 month, I started on chemotherapy. I was supposed to go for radiotherapy, but the machine was down for many months. So I missed that, but I proceeded for hormonal therapy. I was more of an outpatient than a hospital patient, but it was very uncomfortable. Because after chemotherapy, I would go home and people didn't know what to do. if you needed to vomit. I mean, when I felt nausea, when I felt bad, people didn't know what to do. And we always kept running back to hospital.
What has having had breast cancer meant to your life?
To me, at that time, I felt it was the end of my life. You know, I had finished my university, I had got a job, I was preparing for to get married and develop my career, and then cancer came in. So it was like a cutoff. I couldn't continue with my career, and I was worried maybe my boyfriend would leave me. I felt I was a curse.
A curse?
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., cancer survivors are celebrated. Patients and friends and families march in giant parades that extend for miles. Bright pink shirts and bracelets and caps and ribbons are badges of honor.
People feel if you have a member of the family who have had cancer, probably your daughters or sons will not marry because people will be scared about that family. I felt I was alone. Suddenly, I learned later that I'm not alone.
Despite being emotionally and financially supported, I was angry. I didn't feel like I deserved cancer. Not that anyone does. It meant time away from work. There was pain during the post-op period. I had just moved away from most of my friends and family. The disease had taken my mother. Wasn't that enough? I couldn't help it. I was really angry.
Were you ever angry? Well, I was very angry about with myself, with God, with my body betraying me. I was very faithful with my life, and I said, why, when I come from an area which was most hit by HIV? And I said, now I was so careful with my own life to survive HIV, and how come that God gives me cancer this time? I was very angry, but I have outlived the anger.
I don't think breast cancer will kill me, at least not most of the time. But sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, or I read about someone my age dying of breast cancer. And I think about whether or not I'm ready.
Do you ever think you're going to die of breast cancer?
No, as per now, I don't think of dying breast cancer. That's what I feel. I know since I've lived for 10 years, I now die of natural death. First, I thought our experience in Africa would be different from somebody's experience in America, but the fear is the same, the fear of death. I mean, to ask why me? So, I mean, to feel sorry about yourself, and so your experience is good and also touches me, and I feel we have the same destiny.
That was Joanne Silberner reporting from Seattle.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.